Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is a lovely June 26th of 2003. Today's session is Living in a Muslim Community, Session 4 of Out of West Africa, presented by Anne and Willie Longji. The number of this is LAA2003-04. Let's listen in.
Or Tom.
Or somebody.
Or whoever.
Or somebody.
We're Anne and Willie Longji.
Oh.
Many of you have seen us before, and we've had a chance really to get to know a few of you. It's really fun. And nice to be in a place where we get to stay put for a few days. So we've been traveling a lot. Before getting to Holden, we'd spent 6 weeks traveling around to different churches, synod assemblies of the ELCA, and hadn't spent more than two nights in the same bed. So the Holden beds are really great. Today the subject isn't maybe quite as serious as yesterday's subject, which was when we talked about HIV and AIDS in Africa. And some of you were here the other day when we talked about the living in a Muslim community, but more our personal experience, just as being the only Christians in our neighborhood and such, and how we live in that place. Just quickly, another snapshot of Senegal. Where's Senegal? Do you guys know? Some of you do. Why not? Well, here is, I know this isn't really visible, but there's the African continent. Senegal is the furthest western country on the continent, so it's way over here. And it's a former French colony, so French is the official language, not the language spoken on the street, but used in formal education when some business and offices, government offices and things like that. On the street, people use mainly Wolof, the language of the largest ethnic group in the country, so that's sort of used as a commercial language. But there's like 8 to 10 major ethnic groups in Senegal. So if you're of that ethnic group, you will speak your maternal language will be of that ethnic group. And then you might learn Wolof on the street. So we work in an area where half the population is probably Wolof and the other half are Pular. And so both of us have studied some Pular. And in fact, the lyrics on the board are written in Pular. And we'll get back to that in a little bit. So that's just an idea of geography and demography. What else do we need to share?
Do each of the dialects have the written language?
They are now, I think all of the languages in Senegal do take a written form. So
like the Bible translators been there?
Yeah, they've been very involved in that. But I think there was work done maybe even before Wycliffe, at least with some of the languages.
Is the political climate calm, or is it a problem between the tribes?
No, there's no problem between the tribes. That we know of. If there was any problems between the tribes, we would know, because it's not very big, and the news spreads pretty well.
So I think there's always a struggle as to, even last year there was a campaign during the National Literacy Week, and for the past couple of years they've been doing that, to make the civil servants, people who work in the government, literate in their maternal languages. And initially they were only going to provide a couple of the major languages. Well, then there is an issue, because then people say, well, but I'm not one of those groups, so you also have to respond to my needs. And the same, they're trying to introduce national languages, Wolof, Pular, Dola, etc., into primary schools. It's sort of a pilot project. So half of first graders this year were going to start having some of their classes taught in their maternal languages. There too it was a problem because there are regions of the country that if you're not from, I mean, ethnic groups tend to be found in different regions. But you can always, of course, have somebody from another region, another ethnic group in, you know, a foreign region. How do you make sure that they also are included? So it's not that there isn't sometimes tension, but it seems to, in most cases, not create huge political problems or violence or anything like that. So, yes?
Are the smaller language groups disappearing, or are they all kind of maintaining the same strength they've had for decades? Or is there some languages that are becoming more dominant?
Well, I think in the case of Senegal, we can say the Wolof language is more dominant because that's the language that has become national and is used in the streets. But as far as other ethnic languages disappearing, I don't think that is the case because people still, you can still find an ethnic group that is referred to a particular region. For example, if you know that you are in this, you're going to this part of the country, then you're going to meet this region and you can say, I'm going to this ethnic group. Like the northern part is mainly Hula. So when you talk, and where we, the area where we live is called Jolof. So when you talk of Jolof, the people know you're talking Hula, or the Hula people. So I think it's difficult for the language to completely disappear. We see that in other areas, it's possible, but in Senegal, that's not the...
Yeah, we don't... See, the thing is, though, our experience is mainly with the two larger groups, and even with the three largest groups, because then three or four, because Sarah and Jola are probably the next ones, and we also have some context with that language, but I think the other thing that makes it difficult and that does say that, yes, people are losing their language is intermarriage. So if you have a Wolof woman and a Pular man who marry and they live in the capital city, which is a mix of people, probably, unless the Pular speaker makes a real point of speaking Pular with the kids, they're going to end up just learning and using Wolof. And so there's even a term, and we'll maybe talk about it some more tomorrow when we speak more specifically about the Pular, that refers to the Pular who have been... uprooted. They call them the Pular, the uprooted Pular, are those who have sort of lost some of their roots. And they're still Pular, but many of them, and they claim to be Pular, but they say, you know, I don't really speak Pular, or I don't really practice all of the traditional aspects of my culture and stuff like that. So it's the modernization and change.
I think the idea of keeping the maintaining the different languages is being encouraged a lot because many languages now are being written, mm-hmm. So they're starting to take the written form, and that will help to keep some of them from disappearing.
Yeah.
So is there tension between these different groups, and do they keep separate fairly much?
No, that's where I'd say that's not
no,
really a
that's
problem.
That's not an issue.
No, it's not. So,
Is there one dominant language or more than one language in the mass media?
French in the mass media.
French in the mass media.
Except that they also then do provide some, especially news services, but also some sort of entertainment in the other languages. And in at least probably eight of them, more in Wolof and Pular, and then to varying levels for the other language groups. But
how,
it's like there's a weekly news program in Mande on TV, and there's daily, several times a day you can get Pular language radio news and stuff like that, depending on the region you're in, because some of it is like regional radio too. The television is just national, so
The schools are essentially secular, is that right?
Yeah, they're state.
But But they must have Muslim schools too.
Yeah.
Which particular strains of the Islam are taught in those schools?
That's a really interesting question too, because I try to always use the word formal education to refer to what they inherited from the French. And the other day I didn't, and he got after me, and my dad thought it was cool because we got into this argument in front of everybody. But you should do that again because it's really interesting. But we're not going to do that today. No, we might. Formal education is not universal yet. The government's really pushing to make it universal. A lot of kids never go to a Western-style school. Most kids spend at least some time in Quranic education. So with a Quranic teacher, either locally or they get sent away to do it. In particular, boys get sent away. And for 15 years, depending on the kid and the family and everything else. The government last year also introduced religious education into the schools, and the reason they did that was to hopefully bring some people to understand that, yes, we can make sure that our children are enrolled in formal Western-style education and still get the Quranic education that they need. So it was sort of to ensure that some people who feel like, well, if I send my kids to the Western-style school, they won't learn about religion. It's sort of to respond to that need. And that also is a problem because we're talking about a country that's 95% Muslim, maybe about 5% Christian. The Christians tend to be in certain geographic areas, just like ethnic groups are found in certain areas, although that's mixed up in some areas. So in a community like ours, which is 99 plus percent Muslim, but we do have a few Christian kids, who's going to provide their Christian education at school? Because that's what the idea is that you would get your... It's not to have, like... I remember having a religious education course when I was at school in England when I was 10, and we learned everything. We learned about the world religions. It's not that. It's you will get your Quranic teaching, or you will get your Christian education. But in our town, the few Christian kids that are there, they're in four different primary schools. We only know one Catholic teacher in the whole town, and he's a high school science teacher. So who's going to provide that? So that's a complicated thing. At the same time, you can see where they're getting at it. Does that answer a little bit your question?
Well, see how that is. What kind of Muslim expression of Islam is being
it's Senegalese.
it's
considered Sufism.
Oh, Sufism.
And it is really, most Senegalese consider themselves members of a certain brotherhood, Muslim brotherhood in Senegal, which sort of like we always refer to it like as a denomination. And they are Islam, which came from the Arab world and then through the northern border of Senegal, sort of down like from Morocco in the 11th or 12th century, then combined with traditional beliefs of those different ethnic groups and things like that. And then they have saints and scholars who have been trained in the Arab world and others who have spent all of their lives in Senegal who sort of formed these different brotherhoods. So, but the Muslim the Quranic education would be more by what they call Arabizan, which is, how do you explain that?
Arabic teachers?
Yeah, it's more like Arabic teaching, and it wouldn't be so much focused on those brotherhoods. I'm sure it does to a certain extent, but it would try to be more just general Quranic and Arabic training. So, yeah.
I wanted to ask, we hear so much about the Quranic schools in the Middle East containing strong political content.
Mm-hmm.
Is there also political content in the Quranic schools of Senegal?
Probably some.
But I wouldn't qualify it as strong. Mm-hmm. I would not. It is true when... The religion, the Islam is practiced following the different brotherhoods, like she said. And it is possible that some brotherhood will try to, which has certain political influence, will maybe try to introduce that in schools, but I wouldn't qualify it as strong. It is true these different brotherhood have political influence.
But it's mainly local political stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I think, the kind of stuff that, yeah, we do hear about in the news, which is more, well, there would be certain schools that would maybe preach against American consumerism and globalization and the imperialism of the West and Coca-Cola and Madonna and the whole works, but they're not very many, I don't think. So.
So for you as Christians then living in that country, it doesn't sound real difficult, like you would have a lot of animosity towards you.
Mm-mm. There isn't. It's a secular state. Senegal is not an Islamic republic. If it were, we wouldn't openly be able to be there as workers of a church. Now, I think to get a little more into, to tell some stories about the challenges for the church there, the Senegalese Christian community. It's interesting, like we said, our region is almost exclusively Muslim. And if people have heard of Christians, they've heard of Catholics. And most people think that to be Christian is to be Catholic, or to be Catholic is to be Christian. It's the same thing, you know. So if you say, yeah, I'm Christian, sometimes they'll say, are you Catholic? And you just say, yeah. And I'm not. He is, so he's not lying. But it's just easier that way than to try to get into the whole explanation of the Reformation in Martin Luther King. Because then you just get into, oh yeah, Martin Luther King. No, the guy he was named after. So, and I've had to do that even with Catholics and explain to them. It's been really interesting, in fact.
I think one of the reasons for this is because the first Christians were Catholics, and this is a long time ago, during the colonial times. And the biggest Christian group there now is the Catholic
Church.
It is the Catholic Church. And so people have come to know Christianity as Catholicism. Just to refer to Christian as Catholic.
Right.
And most of the Muslims will ask you if you are not a Muslim, are you Catholic? Meaning, are you Christian? And they are not aware of the fact that there are other denominations.
Roots, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, one of them was the mayor of our town, the new mayor, who had to ask me what is the difference between Catholics and Protestant, because he thought, well, I said I was Catholic, and then he said, well, how are you working with, is this mission here a Catholic mission? And I said, no. I said, well, so what is it? So I had to go into explaining. Well,
this guy is now the minister of agriculture in Senegal.
Yeah.
I mean, Well, he's a loser. Let's just no, I mean that's based so on other
that's,
things.
That's
I didn't even know this.
That's so just an example.
He's just so out there.
Example of how
in all of the other decisions.
People have come to understand. I mean, many people still know Christianity as being Catholic. So that was just to give you
the old mayor
idea.
Would have known the difference. She was like that, but anyway.
Is there an Islamist faction in Senator Lee's politics?
That's dominant?
Or that's rising? Like
faction?
Yeah.
Well, the brotherhood of the Murids is, it's not the largest brotherhood in the country, but it is the most politically powerful at the moment. And almost the majority of the government and the cabinet are members of that group. So there is, at the same time, there's good relations there too. There's not the kind of tension that sometimes we would imagine. So, yeah.
Can you? I don't know what you're planning to get into, but I'm just curious. I'll start with a question.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about kind of their religious life of the Muslim community? Do they have a neighborhood mosque, for example, that they would be members of? Is there a sense of community in that mosque? What values do we share with them as Christians? What
Stop! Hold the rest. Okay? Not that I don't want to hear them, but we've already bit off a big chunk there. How many mosques do we have in our town? 10? 8, I think.
Yeah, they're about 8, but they...
15,000 people.
And they're about 4 big ones, and then you have...
4 smaller ones.
I mean, four
big ones and four smaller ones.
In our town,
of 15,000 people. And yeah, I think people consider themselves members of, or disciples of, the leader of that mosque. So they wouldn't come to us, we wouldn't say, how do they express it? Which, if you sort of ask which mosque they go to. Part of it is based on these brotherhoods again, because the mosques tend to be denominational. Although that's not exclusive either. I mean, you can see people from other denominations worshiping in the other ones.
Right. The mosque, even the structure sometimes will tell you which brotherhood that is. And people refer to themselves as followers. And they use the word Taliban.
That's why I said dislike.
Yeah.
That's the word they use. Yeah.
So you can...
Taliban, like Taliban,
is that where it comes from?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you, when in a neighborhood, if there's a mosque, the most of the people of that neighborhood will pray in that mosque. And if they will go to other neighborhoods, they can still pray in the other mosque. But there's a sense of solidarity due to this fact that there is a leader at this mosque. And those who pray regularly at that mosque will consider themselves disciples of that leader.
Taliban is also the word used for all of those young kids who are students in Quranic schooling of some sort. And some of them live at the teacher's home and are sent from their own homes and then go out begging during the day to get food and stuff like that. So we have Taliban at our house every day coming around asking for stuff. So I think one of the other things you wondered was, you know, is there a solidarity and stuff? This is a copy of an invitation we got. It was probably typed up and printed out at the cultural center that the church runs. And it's an invitation from the imam of the mosque in our neighborhood, explaining where that mosque is. It's from the imam. It's from the woman who is the president of the women's group and the members of a group of elders. And they're asking us to come to take part in or be present for the religious singing festival that they are organizing on a Saturday. And so it normally means coming for a meal. Oftentimes you will also give something, so if we go to something like that, we'll also give some money, which helps them to cover the costs of the food and stuff like that. So there's, that's, they do that, that mosque does that on an annual basis, and they rent tarps and stuff, and they make a big shelter, and then they've got activities going on all day long. So that's sort of the members of that mosque who would be involved in organizing stuff like that. And they organize some other activities, and sometimes they have clothes drives where they ask people to bring used clothes, and they send them to a particular village where that is just full of Quranic schools, that people send their children to that village. And then these kids, you know, they're miserable looking, most of them. It's better when it's out in the rural areas than in the cities, because then they're begging on the sides of the highways. But out in the rural areas, at least, they're working in the fields, and community groups from other places are helping them. So that's maybe to illustrate some of the solidarity. Then what was your next question that I made you stop?
I have a question.
The what?
The similarity. Well, the similarity.
Oh, gosh, I don't know. Somebody else want to try to work on that question?
Respect?
I don't know. Yeah, gosh, that's a big one.
But charity is a shared value, I believe.
Yeah.
Doing good.
Doing good for others.
Helping the poor, especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hospitality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Love for one another is one of the values.
Yeah.
About proselytizing, evangelism, outreach, missionaries, do they?
Yeah.
I guess
they. They do practice that. I mean, I don't know. The problem is we haven't studied Islam. We've lived in a Muslim context and learned from the people around us. So it's hard to know what we see that's in practice is from what we would say is like strict Islam, you know, and what might just be tradition and stuff like that. So, but I think what we already said is we can fairly say that that comes from Islam.
So the mission you work at, is it a non-denominational or is it Lutheran?
We're ELCA missionaries. We're sent by the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.
Even though
he's Catholic.
Even though you're Catholic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought.
Right? Yeah.
You know, when you said.
Mm-hmm. So somehow
believe,
they didn't see that was a problem.
Do you believe your church in your town?
Well, yeah, let's get into that now a little bit. So we got into this whole thing about how mainly people in Senegal would consider that if you're Christian, you're probably Catholic. And the majority of Christians are. And the percentage, the population of Senegal is maybe somewhere around 10 million, and the percentage of Christians varies from 4 to less than that. 4%.
Oh.
Or less than that. And the 95% of those, or 90% of those, are probably Catholic from certain regions. Now, we're in a region that was not touched by Catholic missionaries. So the few Catholics in our community, the real Catholics, not just Christians, but Catholics in our community, are people who have been sent to work there. So they work for the government, and one of the guys works at the jail, and he comes from, he's Jola, and he comes from way down south. The head of the chief police officer, what do we call that? Anyway, the head of the police is Jola, and he comes from way down south. A bunch of the other police officers are Jola and Serer, and they come from down south. The second, we have county commissioner, the second in command, is Sarah, and he comes from another region. So that's the Catholic community with their families. And then this one high school teacher. So that community, I don't know, it's probably about, it's less than 60 people, I think. And until this past year, when the Lutherans and the Catholics got together and decided we were going to open a private preschool, they didn't have a regular place where they would meet for worship. A priest would come every 2 or 3 weeks, and there would be Mass. Normally it was in the living room of one of the Lutheran missionaries' houses, one that's actually been vacant for a few years. But now we're having it on the veranda of the preschool on Sundays. And now that there's regular worship is led by the director of the preschool, who is a Catholic man who's moved to the community to run the preschool. So that's the worshiping community that meets really regularly, that is Catholic. Now there is now also a small Pular-speaking Christian community of people who have been baptized within the past 12 years. And they gather together for Bible study. Only a handful of them actually live in town. Another 30 or so live out in smaller villages outside of our town. The people in town gather together every week for Bible study in Pular on a Thursday. And we'll gather for Word and Sacrament ministry just once a month when one of our Lutheran missionary colleagues, who's a pastor, comes up from the capital city. And then that would include also the people from out in the villages who come to worship on a Saturday once a month. And then they'll spend probably Friday night and maybe even Saturday night in town for worship. Now the two communities, and that community is discussing with two other worshiping communities just outside of the capital city, and they're in the process of writing a constitution, and they have chosen to become Lutheran. The two worshiping communities in Langare use Pular language. The Catholics are from varying ethnic groups, so they use French in worship. So their weekly get-togethers, they don't share very much because they're working in different languages. Occasionally, they do. But the monthly gathering that the Pular Christians have, occasionally a few of the Catholics will come, and especially for big festivals, for Easter and Christmas and things like that. Then we do joint worship and meals and parties and stuff like that. But so there's just a lot of challenges to there being a community in that place as far as whether they find solidarity. They do. They're the minority. They're, you know, as far as what kind of actions can they take, as far as how do they even logistically get together, where are they going to meet, stuff like that. It's real complicated. And that's particular to our rural community, whereas in the capital city, you know, there are probably 20 Catholic churches and other Protestant denominations that are starting to have worshiping communities with church buildings and the whole ball of wax. So anyway, that's a lot to take in. Does that make sense that I just explained? Mm-hmm. Or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah? What does it seem like? What is it? How does it sound? Does it sound strange?
I think it's necessary to point out that these Pular Christians have almost all of them have been accompanied by our Lutheran pastors.
In baptismal preparation, in their Christian and education and spiritual development. And then we're talking about people who, as adults, in at least in our community, who have left Islam and have become Christian.
What are the ramifications?
The Catholic communities is second, third, fourth generation Christians.
What are the ramifications for someone who converts to Christianity now from Islam? Are they cut off from their extended family? Are they ostracized? circumcised? What happened?
We were going to tell a couple of stories of some people, and I think that'll illustrate it a little bit. Do we have time to do that?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Umar Khan? Then who are you going to talk about? Demba? Okay. All right. No, then start with Demba.
Okay, the current leader of the Pula Worshipping Committee, Pula Worshipping Group in Linge, the town where we are, is called Dembaba. And he is, before he became Christian, he was a big Muslim scholar who spent a lot of time in Libya and some Arab countries.
Tunisia, Algeria.
And from the story he tells it that one of the reasons he became he decided to become Christian was just his contact with, he had friends who were Christians when he was back in Libya. And so when he didn't actually find out what Christianity was about when he was in Libya. But when he came back and after he had been in this region and seen what the people practice, he was really disappointed and felt a different call. And so there were three of them actually who came when they came back from North Africa. One day maybe after discussing among themselves, talking to themselves and sharing their experiences back in North Africa, they decided to look for a different way out. And they heard that there was this Lutheran missionary in town, in Linguet. So they went up to him and told him who they are and what they were there for. And this was that they wanted to know more about Jesus Christ. And so they started to, this missionary was a pastor.
No, he wasn't.
He was a vet.
Okay,
he was a vet. And so he started talking to them, discussing with them. But
and he quickly also talked to the church and said,
church.
What do I do about it? To the ELCA and said, what do I do with this?
Yeah.
And so the ELCA didn't send a missionary pastor to work in that place.
And so they worked together with this pastor. And about 12 years ago, three of them were baptized at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that is how this community started.
Yeah.
And what is...
That was before you were there.
Yeah.
Oh, that was, before, yeah, that was like 12 years
12
ago.
Years.
We've been there
yeah,
two
we've
and
been
a half.
There two and a half.
So this is...
We've known him like 2.5 years. And... Well, I think it took quite a long, well, if we thinking about our time, it took quite a long time for the community to grow within this 12 years. And I think what is really interesting here is that he, after the missionary pastor left, because our missionary pastor who was in India had to come back to the U.S. for the education of his children. So when this pastor came back, this Dembaba...
When he left, when he came back,
when he
to,
came
the
back
US.
To the U.S. Dembaba has taken upon himself to do the work this pastor was doing, which was to go out and to share the word with other Muslims and other Pula people. And... one of the things that he told me, which is sort of interesting, is from his experiences is that he said, as a Pula, people don't think that it's possible to become a Christian, or that it's normal to become a Christian. But they have another ethnic group, which is the Sere ethnic group, which is consider, which the pool, they and the Pula consider themselves cousins. The Pula tend to think that it is normal for a Sere to be a Christian. So he said this is something he found out with, from his working with the people. And this, I think one of the reasons is that the Sere is where most of them have become Christians. It's an ethnic group that the Catholic worked with a lot, and so many of them have been.
Even the first president of Senegal, who was a poet and playwright, and was the first black African to be in the Académie Française, so the French Academy of their language, I mean, he was Serer, and he was Catholic. So that also tells you something about Senegal. I think to add about Demba, he was highly respected as a Muslim leader. So in his community, he already had that respect, which also says something about how effective, and he's very charismatic too. You know, he's just got something about him that people love. People admire him. They know that he's very well educated in Islam, so if he became Christian, then it really makes them think. Something happened this past year, which is that his father died, and he is now the elder in his village. He lives in town, he works in town, he goes out to villages and stuff, but you know, he's from the village. You never quit being from your village. And he's the elder there now. He's probably 50. He's about, yeah. And now he has that much more authority, even. So in his case, it was not, I mean, he has fear of some things. Not, it doesn't overpower his faith or his desire to share what he's found. But he didn't have to deal with the ostracism because he already had so much status in his community. What he is sometimes concerned about, I think, but just sort of says, you know, he just lives with it, is that he had, because of his training in North Africa, he had then taught Arabic to the children of the Saudi Arabian diplomats, and had taught Arabic in other contexts of schools that were maybe supported by Saudi Arabians. And they have many times come to him and said, what can we do to bring you back? So luckily they're not of the fanatical fundamentalist sort that they've decided just to get rid of him. But there is, I mean, he does know that he is somebody who is a thorn in the side of very important people. So, I mean, it's a really interesting situation for that. Now I'm going to tell the story about a woman in that same community who's probably like a niece of Demba's. And she and I are about the same age. So she's maybe about 30. And she became the wife of one of the other men who was one of the first men to be baptized. And she was also baptized and prepared for baptism and that Christian education when she was also baptized. Which, you know, women don't have very good status around the world. So you go ahead and also become Christian. Wow, that's pretty amazing stuff. Well, her husband, who seems just like a really gentle, pleasant guy, and is a strong, you know, is faithful, he's quiet, he's not like his charismatic buddy who's leading the community, but this is how he explained it, through his understanding of the Bible and how he feels God calls us to abundant life, he realized that in his marriage he was not fulfilled. So he married a second wife who was the woman he truly loved. Whereas this other woman, it was more of an arranged marriage. Although she had become Christian, she bore his children, he was not feel, he did not feel that there was the marital love that could possibly exist. And he also explained, because then, you know, especially us Western missionaries, and even Willie as a non-Western missionary, we were like, no, you can't just continue to be polygamous and be Christian. I mean, what are you doing here? But his understanding was that Jesus does not speak out against polygamy, but he does speak out against divorce. So he was not about to divorce his first wife, but he did feel that he could take a second wife. So he has since divorced his first wife. And I don't think they're going to get back together. There's always huge attempts at reconciliation because it's this family thing, you know. But she, maybe partially because she's in a family of which several people have become Christian, she's still, she's active more than he is these days. When we worship there, it's more likely that we see her, and she lives 20 kilometers away and has to come by horse cart with other people. But he's most of the time not there. The community had put him on discipline. He had been the treasurer of the congregation, and they said, no, we don't approve of this just blatant decision of yours. And they, you know, they decided on these discipline measures. I don't know. I don't think they've quite resolved it yet, because it's not like there's an official divorce. Not like there was an official wedding to start with, and there wasn't an official divorce, but, you know, the status just keeps changing. So. But she's an illiterate Pilar woman. There are quite a few resources that are developed. No, she's not illiterate. She was an illiterate Pilar woman, but one of the things that she has done is learn to read in Pilar. And there are quite a few resources that exist in Pilar. She's very bright. She tends to be quiet most of the time, but if she ever says something, it's going to be sharp and oftentimes amusing. You know those kinds of characters. So she's really a neat person. I think being a divorced Christian Pilar woman, I mean, it just sounds like
Samaritan woman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think in her situation, she's going to somehow make it work. And partially because she lives in a village where there are other Christians. And there are more baptized men than women, so I think she'll probably end up finding a Christian husband at some point, too. So.
So does she support herself, or?
No, she's gone back to live with her family. So. And she has their youngest child. The 5-year-old girl lives with her father and goes to school in town. So I think that the oldest girl will continue to live with her father. And I would imagine even the 2-year-old, when she's old enough to go to school, would live in town with her father, partially so she can go to school. So, but yeah.
Is there any tourism industry?
Yeah, there is, but not where we live. We're at the end of the pavement, and it's really hot, and there's a lot of milk, but there's some really good bird watching, so if you're into that, but not much else. But you should know, who's going to tell about Omar?
You were talking about Omar.
Okay, I'm going to talk about it. Now here's...
Just to complete it. Yeah, the answer. Tourism is really well developed in Senegal as well.
So beaches?
Yeah, on the beaches.
Natural beaches.
Mm-hmm. West Europeans tend to be the main tourists in that country. So, Omar Kaz, another case. He's a young man who, we're not sure, we were debating this, whether he was at university or if he was working in the capital city. Somehow had contact with people with Campus for Christ or Youth with a Mission, one of those groups, in the capital city and was involved and is very musical and loves the liveliness of that, which is not typical for the other Lard that we know. But he started to worship with the Pular-speaking community in just outside of the capital city, and has become active in that community. I think he was probably baptized when he was with Youth with a Mission. I don't think it was when he started worshiping with this sort of Lutheran community. A couple years ago, he was married to a young Muslim woman. It was someone he wanted to marry, from what I can understand. I don't think it was just a family arrangement. His family isn't aware that he's Christian.
At least,
and he's younger than you. He's maybe my age, too, 30 or 35. His family is not aware, and he doesn't want them to be aware. His wife, we don't think she was aware when they were married. And certainly her family was not. They had a child, and we were invited to the baptism, but it kept getting delayed. And I think the issue was the pastor, John Spaulding, who works with that community outside of Dakar, kept saying to him, look, you can't make the decision to have your child baptized without your wife being aware of the fact that you're Christian. You cannot do in such a secretive fashion. But he so much feared the ostracism of having people know that he was Christian, just in his context, that that held him back. We never ended up going to the baptism, but we know the child was baptized. And the last time we worshipped with the Pular-speaking community in the capital city, his wife was there. So I think she knows what's going on. I don't think she's baptized, but she did attend worship with him and with their child.
What form of ostracism? What kind of ostracism does he fear? Is it physical? Is it economic? Is it social? All the
social.
It's social, man.
Yeah. And probably some economic, just because many people, even at his age, he's unemployed. He's probably still maybe living with a brother or with his parents or something like that. So there's that aspect too that is more economic, but I think the main issue is social. So
is unemployment a big issue?
Oh yeah. Senegal runs on air. A lot of families really struggle to find food every day. I'd say what do you want to call it? The people's economy, so buying and selling, sort of doing odd jobs, things like that, is really the way that a lot of people make sure that they eat every day. Some families now have a family member living overseas who sends money to help. So there's a whole variety of things like that. Yeah.
What is your specific mission out where you are?
Well, I work in community health.
Oh, okay.
So in small villages outside of our town, normally through structures that are health huts, which are village-based clinics. So that's.
Are you a nurse or a doctor?
No, I'm not. I'm a community development worker.
Oh.
So the medical work, the strictly medical stuff is the state, the district health. So we work in very close collaboration with the state.
And I work with a cultural center, which is a youth center. Mm-hmm. It provides educational resources, like library, computers, and sporting facilities. And then I help too with a Hurlers Cooperative, which provides services like animal health care to the population and in milk processing. So we process fresh milk into yogurt.
Oh.
That's just briefly what we do.
Yeah.
Besides making friends.
I have one more question about mosques. How are the imams selected? And that's, is there a church hierarchy, a structure that plays them? Do they have a call process? Someone just stand up in the crowd? Or?
How are imams selected? Do you know?
Well, I think that is sometimes it's inherited. People can inherit that position, and sometimes
if they have the right training,
if they have the right training, of course. And then sometimes it gets very political, and then they have to make an election, or the government has to appoint somebody. Like the case we had recently was a problem at the biggest mosque in Dakar. The imam who was there died. So there was a struggle for succession.
Mm-hmm.
I think the president had to intervene at some point. So I don't think that there is a very specific way of doing it.
So
but usually it's the
that's,
the,
I mean,
the
that's
mosque.
The exceptional thing.
Yeah.
It's the main mosque in the capital city.
Right.
But locally, I think you have elders, all of whom might have had quite advanced training, Quranic training, and they might all be eligible, but just at this point, this person is the imam until he decides he doesn't want to be or until he dies. And then I think it's an issue of the men mainly to decide who will be the next imam, I think.
Yeah, and
on the local level.
And as usual, well, sometimes I think it's also is chosen from a group of elders, like you said, who are really well
well-trained.
But is there any, I get the mosque, you said, are associated with brotherhoods or something, so there's not, we know of a denomination, whether it be an organization that would control several churches.
No.
So it's more of an individual,
yeah.
I think almost like a cult, or there's much more personality in the individual imam. Like you could have one real popular one that might draw people to this mosque.
Yeah, there's some of that.
There's some of that, too.
Yeah.
You've maybe asked this in previous sessions, but what is the ELCA's connection to the church in Senegal?
Good question. Typically, the ELCA, in particular with missionaries, will have missionaries working in countries where we're in partnership with the local Lutheran church. Senegal is one of the exceptions where there has not been a local Lutheran church with whom we're in partnership. So there was a decision in the 70s to send missionaries to work in different fields in Senegal. I think some of those people who first came in the 70s, including, you know, I met even somebody on staff here who said his parents were actually in Senegal for a really short time, maybe in the 70s. I think some of those people felt that they were church planting, and others didn't necessarily consider themselves church planting, but doing more service and caring for their neighbors. At the same time, I think those who thought maybe they were church planting knew that the church they were planning might not grow for 100 years. So it came certainly as a surprise when those first three guys knocked on the door and said, we want to know more about Christ. And that was about 12 or 13 years ago. I think it was in 1990. Right? Yeah. So now the ELCA is there continuing the development work, so the work that, for example, we're involved in, which is responding to the needs of the population, sharing our gifts, And then also accompanying now this new Christian community, which when the people who have decided to be baptized have been baptized, they've been baptized as Christians, as we all are, and not in any way told you are now a Lutheran. So that's why it's sort of been hard even to describe the community, because we get so into the denominational stuff. It's just now at this point, 13 years after those first three became Christian, and then others have become Christian in waves and joined those worshiping groups, that they're sitting down together and saying, no, now we've gotten past just learning about being Christian and have started to understand some of the other issues and dogma and whatever, and they're going to identify themselves as Lutherans. So, I mean,
how many people are in this worshiping community that you're just now describing?
Well, in Lingare, in our town, and in the region around, there are 40 baptized Pular Christians, Pular-speaking Christians. In Dakar, the Pular-speaking Christian community is what, 20? Yeah, 20 or 30. And then there's another French-speaking worshiping group that are mainly Jola and maybe some other ethnic groups. We don't know so well, but they worship in French. And that community is, I don't know, 20, maybe 30, because there's quite a few kids who don't always make the numbers, but they should. So we're talking about a new church that's forming that will be less than 100 people.
And I think after this this church is formed, then the ELCA would then have
a local
church with which it can relate directly.
And eventually,
as is happening in other
right.
countries.
And work towards a comparable situation as is found in like the Central African Republic, where the Central African Church, which has been, which is close to 100 years old, no, not quite, like 70 years old, they request of the ELCA missionaries, or they present their needs to the ELCA and we respond instead of the ELCA deciding what we need to do. See what I mean? So eventually it'll work towards that, but you know, a little tiny group isn't going to be able to handle too much of that burden right to start with. So it'll be interesting to see now the transition and how we work in this situation. So that's a big challenge to us as missionaries and to that Christian community. I mean, in some ways I say, are we just a white elephant because we're there with the projects and the things we're involved in? I don't think it would be appropriate to just, if that church exists and if the ELCA is in partnership with that church, that we all of a sudden say, okay, this is all your responsibility now. You decide how Ann hires people for the health project. You decide how, where the cultural center, what kind of building the cultural center should move into. You decide, you know, because there's all that kind of stuff that we're going to have to deal with. So. Hey, we're over time. And thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You gotta learn a song. It's real easy. Does everybody know the song Tumamina, the South African Send Me Jesus?
Oh, yeah.
Many
sure.
of us do, and it's a real easy melody. Here we have the lyrics, some lyrics in Pular. Walam means help me, and Isa is the word for Jesus. So help me, Jesus. and help me, Jesus, help me, Jesus, help me, Jesus, help me, my Lord, our Savior, Jo Mirado. You can just say the, but it's supposed to be the. So, Jo Mirado. Then, Nelam Isa is send me, Jesus. So, who's going to start? Who's
you.
Walam Isa, Walam Isa, Walam.